The white-braided magician of the Weasel Clan sneered, and also slid off of his pony. Quickly he drew a similar symbol on the ground and stepped into its protection. "That's it," Silk muttered to Garion. "Once the symbols are drawn, neither one can back down." Belgarath and the white-braided magician had each begun muttering incantations in a language Garion had never heard, brandishing their skull-surmounted staves at each other. The dreamer of the Weasel Clan, suddenly realizing that he was in the middle of the impending battle, miraculously recovered from his seizure, scrambled to his feet, and lurched away with a terrified expression. The headman, trying to maintain his dignity, carefully backed his pony out of the immediate vicinity of the two muttering old men. Atop a large white boulder, 20 yards or so to the left of the two magicians, there was a shimmering disturbance in the air, somewhat like heat waves rising from a red tile roof on a hot day. The movement caught Garion's eye, and he stared in puzzlement at the strange phenomenon. As he watched, the shimmering became more pronounced, and it seemed that the shattered pieces of a rainbow infused it, flickering, shifting, undulating in waves, almost like a very huge flame rising from an invisible fire. As Garion watched, fascinated, a second shimmering became apparent, rising above the tall grass off to the right. The second disturbance also began to gather shards of color into itself. As he stared, first at one, then at the other, Garion saw, or imagined that he saw, a shape beginning to emerge in the center of each. The shapes at first were amorphous, shifting, changing, gathering form from the coruscating colors flashing about them in the shimmering air. Then it seemed that the shapes, having reached a certain point, flashed to completion, coalescing quite suddenly with a great rushing together, and two towering forms faced each other, snarling and slathering with mindless hatred. Each stood as high as a house, and their shoulders bulked wide. Their skins were multi-hued, with waves of color rippling through them. The one standing in the grass had a third eye glaring balefully from between its other two, and his great arms ended in 7 clawed hands, stretched out with a hideously hungry curving. His jutting, muzzle-like mouth gaped wide, filled with row upon row of needle-like teeth, as he roared a thunderous howl of hatred and dreadful hunger. Crouched upon the other boulder stood another. He had a great cluster of shoulders at the top of his trunk, and a nest of long, scaly arms that writhed out in all directions like snakes, each arm terminating in a widespread, many-clawed hand. 2 sets of eyes, one atop the other, glared insanely from beneath heavy brow ridges, and his muzzle, like that of the other figure, sprouted a forest of teeth. He raised that awful face and bellowed, his jaws drooling foam. But even as the two monsters glared at each other, there seemed to be a kind of writhing struggle going on inside them. Their skins rippled, and large moving lumps appeared in odd places on their chests and sides. Garion had the peculiar feeling that there was something else, something quite different and perhaps even worse, trapped inside of each apparition. Growling, the two devils advanced upon each other, but despite their apparent eagerness to fight, they seemed almost driven, whipped toward the struggle. It was as if there was a dreadful reluctance in them, and their grotesque faces jerked this way and that, each snarling first at his opponent and then at the magician who controlled him. That reluctance, Garion perceived, stemmed from something deep inside the nature of each devil. It was the enslavement, the compulsion to do the bidding of another that they hated, the chains of spell and incantation in which Belgarath and the white-braided Morind had bound them were an intolerable agony, and there were whimpers of that agony mingled with their snarls. Belgarath was sweating. Droplets of perspiration trickled down his dark, stained face. The incantations which held the devil of Grinja locked within the apparition he had created to bind it rippled endlessly from his tongue. The slightest faltering of either the words or the image he had formed in his mind would break his power over the beast that he had summoned, and it would turn upon him. Writhing like things attempting to tear themselves apart from within, Akhrinja and Horja closed on each other, grappling, clawing, tearing out chunks of scaly flesh with their awful jaws. The earth shuddered beneath them as they fought. Too stunned to even be afraid, Geryon watched the savage struggle. As he watched, he noted a peculiar difference between the two apparitions. Akhrinja was bleeding from his wounds, a strange dark blood so deep red as to be almost black. Horja, however, did not bleed. Chunks ripped from his arms and shoulders were like bits of wood. The white-braided magician saw that difference as well, and his eyes grew suddenly afraid. His voice became shrill as he desperately cast incantations at Horja, struggling to keep the devil under his control. The moving lumps beneath Horja's skin became larger, more agitated. The vast devil broke free from Akhrinja and stood, his chest heaving and a dreadful hope burning in his eyes. White Braids was screaming now. The incantations tumbled from his mouth, faltering and stumbling. And then one unpronounceable formula tangled his tongue. Desperately he tried it again, and once again it stuck in his teeth. With a bellow of triumph, the devil Horja straightened and seemed to explode. Bits and fragments of scaly hide flew in all directions as the monster shuddered free of the illusion which had bound him. He had two great arms and an almost human face, surmounted by a pair of curving, needle-pointed horns. He had hooves instead of feet, and his grayish skin dripped slime. He turned slowly, and his burning eyes fixed on the gibbering magician.
"Horja!" the white-braided Morin shrieked. "I command you!"
The words faltered as he gaped in horror at the devil which had suddenly escaped his control.
"Horja! I am your master!"
But Horja was already stalking toward him, his great hoofs crushing the grass as step by step he moved toward his former master. In wild-eyed panic, the white-braided Morint flinched back, stepping unconsciously and fatally out of the protection of the circle and star drawn upon the ground. The demon smiled then, a chilling smile. Benton caught the shrieking magician by each ankle, ignoring the blows rained on his head and shoulders by the skull-topped staff. Then the monster stood up, lifting the struggling man to hang upside down by the legs. The huge shoulders surged with an awful power, and leering hideously, the devil deliberately and with a cruel slowness tore the magician in two. The Merindim fled. Contemptuously, the immense devil hurled the chunks of his former master after them, spattering the grass with blood and worse. Then, with a savage hunting cry, he leaped in pursuit of them. The three-eyed Akhrinja had stood, still locked in a half-crouch, watching the destruction of the white-braided Morind almost with indifference. When it was over, he turned to cast eyes burning with hatred upon Belgarath. The old sorcerer, drenched with sweat, raised his skull staff in front of him, his face set with extreme concentration. The interior struggle rippled more intensely within the form of the monster, but gradually Belgarath's will mastered and solidified the shape. Akhrinja howled in frustration, clawing at the air until all hint of shifting or changing was gone. Then the dreadful hands dropped, and the monster's head bowed in defeat.
"Begone,"
Belgarath commanded almost negligently, and Akhrinja instantly vanished. Geryon suddenly began to tremble violently. His stomach heaved. He turned, tottered a few feet away, and fell to his knees and began to retch.
"What happened?"
Silk demanded in a shaking voice.
"It got away from him,"
Belgarath replied calmly.
"I think it was the blood that did it."
When he saw that Akhrinja was bleeding, and that Horja was not,
He realized that he had forgotten something. That shook his confidence. And he lost his concentration. Garion, stop that.
I can't,
Garion groaned, his stomach heaving violently again.
How long will Horja chase the others? Until the sun goes down. I imagine that the Weasel Clan is in for a bad afternoon.
Is there any chance that he will turn around and come after us?
He has no reason to. We did not try to enslave him. As soon as Garion gets his stomach under control again, we can go on. We won't be bothered anymore.
Garion stumbled to his feet, weakly wiping at his mouth.
Are you all right?
Not really. But there's nothing left to come up.
Get a drink of water. Try not to think about it.
Will you have to do that anymore?
Silk asked, his eyes a bit wild.
No,
Belgareth pointed. There were several riders along the crest of a hill, perhaps a mile away.
The other Morindum in the area watched the whole thing. The word will spread, and nobody will come anywhere near us now. Let's mount up and get going. It is still a very long way to the coast.
In bits and pieces, as they rode for the next several days, Garion picked up as much information as he really wanted about the dreadful contest that he had witnessed.
It is the shape that's the key to the whole thing,
Belgareth concluded.
What the Morindum call devil spirits don't look that much different from humans. You form an illusion drawn out of your imagination and force the spirit into it. As long as you can keep it locked up in that illusion, it has to do what you tell it to. If the illusion falters for any reason, the spirit breaks free and resumes its real form. After that, you have no control over it whatsoever. I have a certain advantage in these matters. Changing back and forth from a man to a wolf has sharpened my imagination a bit.
Why did Belden say that you were a bad magician, then?
Silk asked curiously.
Belden's a purist, the old man shrugged. He feels that it's necessary to get everything into the shape, down to the last scale and toenail. It isn't really, but he feels that way about it.
Do you suppose we could talk about something else?
Garion asked. They reached the coastline a day or so later. The sky had remained overcast, and the sea of the east lay sullen and rolling under dirty gray clouds. The beach along which they rode was a broad shingle of black round stones littered with chunks of white bleached driftwood. Waves rolled, foaming up the beach, only to slither back with an endless mournful sigh. Seabirds hung in the stiff breeze, screaming at them.
Which way? Silk asked.
Belgareth looked around.
North, he replied.
How far?
I'm not positive. It's been a long time, and I can't be sure exactly where we are.
You're not the best guide in the world, old friend,
Sulk complained.
Yes, you can't have everything.
They reached the land bridge 2 days later, and Garion stared at it in dismay. It was not at all what he had expected, but consisted of a series of round, wave-eroded white boulders sticking up out of the dark water and running in an irregular line off toward a dark smudge on the horizon. The wind was blowing out of the north, carrying with it a bitter chill and the smell of polar ice. Patches of white froth stretched from boulder to boulder as the swells ripped themselves to tatters on the submerged reefs.
"How are we supposed to cross that?"
Silk objected.
We wait until low tide,
Belgareth explained.
The reefs are mostly out of the water then.
Mostly.
We might have to wade a bit from time to time. Let's strip these furs off our clothes before we start. It will give us something to do while we're waiting for the tide to turn. And they are starting to get a bit, fragrant.
They took shelter behind a pile of driftwood, far up on the beach, and removed the stiff, smelly furs from their clothing. Then they dug food out of their packs and ate. Garion noted that the stain that had darkened the skin on his hands had begun to wear thin, and that the tattoo drawings on the faces of his companions had grown noticeably fainter. It grew darker, and the period of twilight that separated one day from the next seemed longer than it had no more than a week ago.
"Summer is nearly over up here,"
Belgareth noted, looking out at the boulders gradually emerging from the receding water in the murky twilight.
"How much longer before low tide?" Silk asked.
"Another hour or so."
They waited. The wind pushed at the pile of driftwood erratically and brushed the tall grass along the upper edge of the beach, bending and tossing it. Finally, Belgareth stood up.
"Let's go,"
he said shortly.
"We will lead the horses. The reefs are slippery, so be careful how you set your feet down."
The passage along the reef between the first stepping stones was not all that bad, but once they moved farther out, the wind became a definite factor. They were frequently drenched with stinging spray, and every so often a wave, larger than the others, broke over the top of the reef and swirled about their legs, tugging at them. The water was brutally cold.
"Do you think that we'll be able to make it all the way across before the tide comes back in?"
Silk shouted over the noise.
"No," Belgareth shouted back. "We'll have to sit it out on top of one of the larger rocks."
"That sounds unpleasant."
"Not nearly as unpleasant as swimming."
They were perhaps halfway across when it became evident that the tide had turned. Waves more and more frequently broke across the top of the reef, and one particularly large one pulled the legs of Geryon's horse out from under him. Geryon struggled to get the frightened animal up again, pulling at the reins as the horse's hoofs scrambled and slid on the slippery rocks of the reef.
"We'd better find a place to stop, Grandfather," he yelled above the crash of the waves. "We'll be neck deep in this before long."
"Two more islands," Belgareth told him. "There's a bigger one up ahead."
The last stretch of the reef was completely submerged, and Geryon flinched as he stepped down into the icy water. The breaking waves covered the surface with froth, making it impossible to see the bottom. He moved along blindly, probing the unseen path with numb feet. A large wave swelled and rose up as far as his armpits, and its powerful surge swept him off his feet. He clung to the reins of his horse, floundering and sputtering as he fought to get back up. And then they were past the worst of it. They moved along the reef with the water only ankle-deep now. A few moments later they climbed up onto the large white boulder. Geryon let out a long, explosive breath as he reached safety. The wind blowing against his wet clothing chilled him to the bone, but at least they were out of the water. Later, as they sat huddled together on the leeward side of the boulder, Geryon looked out across the sullen black sea toward the low, forbidding coastline lying ahead. The beaches, like those of Morrendland behind them, were black gravel, and the low hills behind them were dark under the scudding gray cloud. Nowhere was there any sign of life, but there was an implicit threat in the very shape of the land itself.
"Is that it?"
he asked finally in a hushed voice. Belgareth's face was unreadable as he gazed across the open water toward the coast ahead.
"Yes," he replied. "That is Meloria."
Part 2. Mishrach Achtul. Chapter 8. The crown had been Queen Aelina's first mistake. It was heavy, and it always gave her a headache. Her decision to wear it had come originally out of a sense of insecurity. The bearded warriors in Unheg's throne room intimidated her, and she felt the need of a visible symbol of her authority. Now she was afraid to appear without it. Each day she put it on with less pleasure and entered the main hall of Unheg's palace with less certainty. The sad truth was that Queen Aelina of Kerik was completely unprepared to rule. Until the day when, dressed in regal crimson velvet and with her gold crown firmly in place, she had marched into the vaulted throne room at Val Alorn to announce that she would rule the kingdom in her husband's absence, Eileena's most momentous decisions had involved which gown she would wear and how her hair was to be arranged. Now it seemed that the fate of Kerach hung in the balance each time she was faced with a choice. The warriors lounging indolently with their ale cups about the huge open fire pit, or wandering aimlessly about on the rush-strewn floor, were no help whatsoever. Each time she entered the throne room, all conversation broke off, and they rose to watch as she marched to the banner-hung throne, but their faces gave no hint of their true feelings toward her. Irrationally, she concluded that the whole problem had to do with the beards. How could she possibly know what a man was thinking when his face was sunk up to the ears in hair? Only the quick intervention of Lady Merrill, the cool blonde wife of the Earl of Trelheim, had stopped her from ordering a universal shave.
"You can't, Eileena,"
Merrill had told her flatly, removing the quill from the Queen's hand, even as she had been in the act of signing the hastily drawn-up proclamation.
"They are attached to their beards like little boys attached to a favorite toy. You can't make them cut off their whiskers." I'm the Queen." "Only as long as they permit you to be. They accept you out of respect for Anhag, and that's as far as it goes. If you tamper with their pride, they'll take you off the throne."
And that dreadful threat had ended the matter then and there. Eileena found herself relying more and more on Barak's wife, and it was not long before the two of them, one in green and the other in royal crimson, were seldom apart. Even when Eileena faltered, Merrill's icy stare quelled the hints of disrespect which cropped up from time to time, usually when the ale had been distributed a bit too freely. It was Merrill, ultimately, who made the day-to-day decisions which ran the kingdom. When Eileena sat upon the throne, Merrill, her blonde braids coiled about her head to form her own crown, stood to one side in plain view of the hesitant queen. Kerach was ruled by the expressions on her face. A faint smile meant yes, a frown no, a scarcely perceptible shrug maybe. It worked out fairly well. But there was one person who was not intimidated by Merrill's cool gaze, Grodeg, the towering white-bearded high priest of Pelar, inevitably requested private audience with the queen, and once Merrill left the council room, Eileena was lost. Despite Anhag's call for a general mobilization, the members of the bear cult had not yet left to join the campaign. Their promises to join the fleet later all sounded sincere, but their excuses and delays grew more and more obvious as time went on. Eileena knew that Grodeg was behind it all. Nearly every able-bodied man in the kingdom was off with the fleet, which was even now rowing up the broad expanse of the Aldua River to join Anhag in central Agaria. The household guard in the palace at Val'Alorn had been reduced to grizzled old men and downy-cheeked boys. Only the bear cult remained, and Grodeg pushed his advantage to the limit. He was polite enough, bowing to the queen when the occasion demanded, and never mentioning her past links with the cult. But his offers to help became more and more insistent, and when Eileena faltered at his suggestions concerning this matter or that, he smoothly acted to implement them as if her hesitancy had been acceptance. Little by little, Eileena was losing control, and Grodeg, with the armed might of the cult behind him, was taking charge. More and more, the cult members infested the palace, giving orders, lounging about the throne room, and openly grinning as they watched Eileena's attempts to rule.
"You're going to have to do something, Eileena,"
Merrill said firmly one evening, when the two were alone in the queen's private apartment. She was striding about the carpeted room, her hair gleaming like soft gold in the candlelight, but there was nothing soft in her expression.
"What can I do?"
Eileena pleaded, wringing her hands.
"He's never openly disrespectful, and his decisions always seem to be in the best interests of Kerach." "You need help, then, Eileena,"
Merrill told her.
"But whom can I turn to?"
The Queen of Kerach was almost in tears. The Lady Merrill smoothed the front of her green velvet gown.
I think that it's time that you wrote to Porin,
she declared.
And what do I say?
Eileena begged of her. Merrill pointed at the small table in the corner where parchment and ink lay waiting.
Sit down,
she instructed,
and write what I tell you to write.
Count Bredor, the Tolnedrin ambassador, was definitely growing tiresome. The plump little Queen Layla marched purposefully toward the chamber where she customarily gave audiences, and where the ambassador awaited her with his satchel full of documents. The courtiers in the halls bowed as she passed, her crown slightly askew, and her heels clicking on the polished oak floors. But Queen Layla uncharacteristically ignored them. This was not the time for polite exchanges or idle chit-chat. The Tolnedrin had to be dealt with, and she had delayed too long already. The ambassador was an olive-skinned man with receding hair and a hooked nose. He wore a brown mantle with the gold trim that indicated his relationship to the Boruns. He lounged rather indolently in a large cushioned chair near the window of the sunny room where he and Queen Layla were to meet. He rose as she entered and bowed with exquisite grace. "Your Highness," he murmured politely.
"My dear Count Bredor," Queen Layla gushed at him, putting on her most helpless and scatterbrained expression. "Oh, please do sit down. I'm sure we know each other well enough by now to skip all of those tedious formalities."
She sank into a chair, fanning herself with one hand.
"It's turned warm, hasn't it?"
"The summers are lovely in Zendaya, Your Highness,"
the Count replied, settling back in his chair.
"I wonder, have you had the chance to think over the proposals that I gave you at our last meeting?"
Queen Layla stared at him blankly.
"Oh, which proposals were those, Count Bredor?"
She gave him a helpless little giggle.
"Oh, please do forgive me, but my mind seems to be absolutely gone these days. There are so many details. I wonder how my husband keeps him all straight."
"We were discussing the administration of the Port of Kalar, Your Highness,"
the Count reminded her gently.
"We were?"
The Queen gave him a blank look of total incomprehension, secretly delighted at the flicker of annoyance that crossed his face. It was her best ploy. By pretending to have forgotten all previous conversations, she forced him to begin at the beginning every time they met. The Count's strategy, she knew, depended upon a gradual build-up to his final proposal, and her pretended forgetfulness neatly defeated that.
"Whatever led us into such a tedious subject as that?"
she added.
"Surely, Your Highness recalls,"
the Count protested with just the slightest hint of annoyance.
"The Tolnedrin merchant vessel, the Star of Tolhorb, was kept standing at anchor for a week and a half in the harbor before moorage could be found for her. Every day's delay in unloading her was costing a fortune."
"Oh, things are so hectic these days,"
the Queen of Sindaria sighed.
"It's the manpower shortage, you understand. Everybody who hasn't gone off to war is busy freighting supplies to the army. I'll send a very stern note to the port authorities about it, though. Was there anything else, Count Bredor?"
Bredor coughed uncomfortably.
"Your Majesty has already forwarded just such a note,"
he reminded her.
"I have?"
Queen Layla feigned astonishment.
"Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that takes care of everything, doesn't it, then? And you've dropped by to thank me."
She smiled girlishly.
"How exquisitely courteous of you."
She leaned forward to put one hand impulsively on his wrist, quite deliberately knocking the rolled parchment he was holding out of his hand.
"Oh, how clumsy of me,"
she exclaimed, bending quickly to pick up the parchment before he could retrieve it. Then she sat back in her chair, tapping the rolled document absently against her cheek, as if lost in thought.
Actually, Your Highness, our discussions had moved somewhat beyond your note to the port authorities,"
Bredor told her, nervously eyeing the parchment she had so deftly taken from him.
You may recall that I offered Tonnetre an assistance in administering the port. I believe we agreed that such assistance might help to alleviate the manpower shortage that Your Highness has just mentioned.
Oh, what an absolutely marvelous idea,
Leila exclaimed. She brought her plump little fist down on the arm of her chair, as if in an outburst of enthusiasm. At that prearranged signal, two of her younger children burst into the room, arguing loudly.
Mother!
Princess Gelda wailed in outrage.
Fanny stole my red ribbon. I did not,
Princess Ferna denied the charge indignantly.
She gave it to me for blue beads. Did not,
Gelda snapped.
Did so,
Ferna replied.
Children, children,
Leila chided them.
Can't you see that Mother's busy? Now what will the dear Count think of us?
But she stole it, Mother. She stole my red ribbon. Did not,
Fanny said, spitefully sticking her tongue out at her sister. Trailing behind them with a look of wide-eyed interest came little Prince Meldig, Queen Layla's youngest child. In one hand the prince held a jam pot, and his face was liberally smeared with the contents.
Oh, that's just impossible,
Leila exclaimed, jumping to her feet.
You girls are supposed to be watching him.
She bustled over to the jam-decorated prince, crumpled the parchment she was holding, and began wiping his face with it. Abruptly she stopped.
Oh, dear,
she said, as if suddenly realizing what she was doing.
Was this important, Count Braedor?
She asked the Tolnedrin, holding out the rumpled, sticky document. Braedor's shoulders, however, had slumped in defeat.
No, Your Highness, he replied in a voice filled with resignation. Not really. The Royal House of Shandaria has me quite outnumbered, it appears.
He rose to his feet.
Perhaps another time, he murmured, bowing. With Your Highness's permission, he said, preparing to leave.
Oh, you mustn't forget this, Count Braedor,
Leila said, pressing the parchment into his cringing hands. The Count's face had a faintly martyred expression as he withdrew. Queen Leila turned back to her children, who were grinning impishly at her. She began to scold them in a loud voice until she was certain the Count was well out of earshot. Then she knelt, embraced them all, and began to laugh.
Did we do it right, Mother?
Princess Gelda asked.
Oh, you are absolutely perfect,
Queen Leila replied, still laughing.
Tsadi, the eunuch, had grown careless, lulled somewhat by the air of polite civility that had pervaded the palace at Stithis Tor for the past year, and one of his associates, seizing upon his unwariness, had taken the opportunity to poison him. Tsadi definitely did not appreciate being poisoned. The antidotes all tasted vile, and the after-effects left him weak and light-headed. Thus it was that he viewed the appearance of the mail-shirted emissary of King Tar Urgas with thinly veiled irritation.
Tar Urgas, King of the Murkos, greets Tsadi, chief servant of the Moto Salmishra,
the Murgo declaimed with a deep bow as he entered the cool, dimly lighted study from which Tsadi conducted most of the nation's affairs.
The servant of the Serpent Queen returns the greetings of the right arm of the dragon god of Angarak,
Tsadi mouthed the formula phrases almost indifferently.
Do you suppose that we could get to the point? I'm feeling a bit indisposed at the moment.
I was very pleased at your recovery,
the ambassador lied, his scarred face carefully expressionless. Has the poisoner been apprehended yet?
He drew up a chair and sat down at the polished table that Tsadi used for a desk.
Naturally,
Tsadi replied, absently rubbing his hand over his shaved scalp.
And executed?
Why would we want to do that? The man's a professional poisoner. He was only doing his job.
The Murgo looked a bit startled.
We look upon a good poisoner as a national asset, Zadi told him. If we start killing them every time they poison somebody, very soon there won't be any of them left. And you never know when I might want somebody poisoned. The Murgo ambassador shook his head incredulously.
You people have an amazing amount of tolerance, Zadi,
he said in his harshly accented voice.
What about his employer?
That's another matter, Zadi replied. His employer is currently entertaining the leeches at the bottom of the river. Is your visit official, or did you merely stop by to inquire after my health?
A bit of each, Excellency.
You Murgos are an economical race,
Zadi observed dryly.
What does Tarogos want this time?
The Alans are preparing to invade Mishrech Achtul, Your Excellency.
So I've heard. What's that got to do with Nissa?
Nissans have no reason to be fond of the Alans.
Nor are they to be fond of the Murgos, either, Zeddy pointed out.
It was Loria that invaded Nissa following the death of the Raven King,
the Murgo reminded him.
And it was Kthal Murgos that provided the market for Nyssa's primary export.
My dear fellow, please get to the point, Zadi said, rubbing his scalp wearily. I'm not going to operate on the basis of long-past insults or long-forgotten favors. The slave trade is no longer significant, and the scars left by the Alon invasion disappeared centuries ago. What does Tarogos want?
My king wishes to avoid bloodshed. The Tornadron legions form a significant part of the armies massing in Algaria. If a threat, just a threat, mind you, of unfriendly activity suddenly appeared on his unprotected southern frontier, Ranborun would recall those legions. Their loss would persuade the Alans to abandon this adventure.
You want me to invade Tornadra?
Zadi demanded incredulously.
Naturally not, Lord Zadi. His Majesty merely wishes your permission to move certain forces through the territory to pose a threat on the Tornadran southern border. No blood need to be shed at all.
Except Nason blood, once the Murgo army withdraws. The legions would swarm down across the river of the woods like angry hornets.
Tarogos would be more than willing to leave garrisons behind to guarantee the integrity of Nissan territory.
And sure he would, Zadi observed dryly. Advise your king that his proposal is quite unacceptable at this particular time.
The king of Kthal Murgos is a powerful man,
the Murgo said firmly,
and he remembers those who thwart him even more keenly than he remembers his friends.
Tarogos is a madman,
Zadi told him bluntly.
He wants to avoid trouble with the Alans, so that he can concentrate on Zachath. Despite his insanity, however, he is not so foolish as to send an army into Nissa uninvited. An army must eat, and Nissa is a bad place to forage for food, as history has demonstrated. The most tempting fruit
has bitter juice.
A Murgo army carries its own food,
the ambassador replied stiffly.
Good for them. But where do they plan to find drinking water? I don't believe we're getting anywhere with this. I'll convey your proposal to Her Majesty. She, of course, will make the final decision. I suspect, however, that you will need to offer something much more attractive than a permanent Murgo occupation to persuade her to consider the matter favorably. Was that all?
The Murgo rose to his feet, his scarred face angry. He bowed coldly to Tzadi and withdrew without further conversation.
Tzadi thought about it for a while. He could gain a great deal of advantage at a minimal cost if he played this right. A few carefully worded dispatches to King Rodar in Algeria would put Nyssa among the friends of the West. If Rodar's army should happen to win, Nyssa would benefit. If, on the other hand, it appeared that the West were about to lose, the proposal of Taurogas could be accepted. In either case, Nyssa would be on the winning side. The whole notion appealed to Tzadi enormously. He stood up, his iridescent silk robe rustling, and went to a nearby cabinet. He took out a crystal decanter containing a dark blue liquid. He carefully measured some of the thick syrup into a small glass and drank it. Almost immediately, a euphoric calm came over him as his favorite drug took effect. A moment or two later, he felt that he was ready to face his queen. He was even smiling as he walked from his study into the dim corridor leading to the throne room. As always, Somisra's chamber was dimly lighted by oil lamps hanging on long silver chains from the shadowy ceiling. The chorus of eunuchs still knelt adoringly in the queen's presence, but they no longer sang her praises. Noise of any kind irritated Somisra now, and it was wise not to irritate her. The Serpent Queen still occupied the throne beneath the towering statue of Issa. She dozed interminably, stirring her mottled coils with the seething dry hiss of scale rubbing against scale. But even in restless doze, her tongue flickered nervously. Tzadi approached the throne, perfunctorily prostrating himself on the polished stone floor, then waited. His scent on the air would announce him to the hooded serpent who was his queen.
"Yes, Tzadi,"
she whispered finally, her voice a dusty hiss.
"The Murgos. Wish an alliance, my queen," Tzadi informed her. "Taurogas wants to threaten the Tolnedrans from the south, to force Ran Barun to withdraw his legions from the Tullish border."
"Interesting,"
she replied indifferently. Her dead eyes bored into him and her coils rustled.
"What do you think?"
"Neutrality costs nothing, Divine Salmisra," Tzadi replied. "Alliance with either side would be premature."
Salmisra turned, her mottled hood flaring as she regarded her reflection in the mirror beside the throne. The crown still rested on her head, as polished and glistening as her scales. Her tongue flickered and her eyes, flat as glass, looked at the mirror.
"Do what you think best, Tzadi,"
she told him in an uncaring tone.
"I'll deal with the matter, my queen,"
Tzadi said, putting his face to the floor in preparation to leave.
"I have no need of Torak now,"
she mused, still staring at the mirror.
"Polkara saw to that."
"Yes, my queen,"
Tzadi agreed in a neutral voice, beginning to rise. She turned to look at him.
"Stay a while, Tzadi. I'm lonely.
Teddy sank immediately back to the polished floor.
"I have such strange dreams sometimes, Teddy,"
she hissed.
"Such very strange dreams. I seem to remember things. Things that happened when my blood was warm and I was a woman. Strange thoughts come to me in my dreams, and strange hungers."
She looked directly at him, her hood flaring again, as her pointed face stretched out toward him.
"Was I really like that, Teddy? It all seems like something seen through smoke."
"It was a difficult time, my queen," Teddy replied candidly. "For all of us."
"Polgara was right, you know,"
she continued in that expiring whisper.
"The potions inflamed me. I think it's better this way. No passions, no hungers, no fears."
She turned back to her mirror.
"You may go now, Teddy."
He rose and started toward the door.
"Oh, Teddy."
"Yes, my queen."
"If I caused you trouble before, I'm sorry."
He stared at her.
"Not very much, of course, but just a little."
Then she returned to her reflection. Teddy was trembling as he closed the door behind him. Sometime later, he sent for Issus. The shabby, one-eyed hireling entered the chief eunuch's study with a certain hesitancy, and his face was a bit apprehensive.
"Come in, Issus," Teddy told him calmly.
"I hope you aren't holding any grudges, Teddy,"
Issus said nervously, looking about to be sure they were alone.
"There was nothing personal in it, you know."
"It's all right, Issus," Teddy assured him. "You were only doing what you were paid to do."
"How did you manage to
detect it?"
Issus asked with a certain professional curiosity.
"Most men are too far gone for the antidote to work before they realize that they have been poisoned. Your concoction leaves just the faintest aftertaste of lemon," Teddy replied. "I have been trained to recognize it."
"Ah," Issus said,
"I'll have to work on that. Otherwise, it's a very good poison."
"An excellent poison, Issus," Teddy agreed. "That brings us to the reason I sent for you. There's a man I think I can dispense with."
Issus' single eye brightened, and he rubbed his hands together.
"The usual fee?"
"Naturally."
"Who is he?"
"The Murgo ambassador."
Issus' face clouded for a moment.
"He'll be difficult to get to."
He scratched at his stubbled scalp.
"You'll find a way. I have the utmost confidence in you."
"I am the best,"
Issus agreed with no trace of false modesty.
"The ambassador is pressing me on certain negotiations that I need to delay,"
Teddy continued.
"His sudden demise should interrupt things a bit." "You don't really have to explain, Teddy,"
Issus told him. "I don't need to know why you want him killed.
But you do need to know how. For various reasons, I'd like for this to look very natural. Could you arrange for him, and perhaps a few others in his household, to come down with some kind of fever? Something suitably virulent."
Issus frowned.
That is tricky.
Something like that can get out of hand. You might end up infecting an entire neighborhood, and there would be very few survivors.
Tadi shrugged.
One sometimes must make sacrifices. Can you do it?
Issus nodded gravely.
Do it, then, and I'll compose a letter expressing my regrets to King Tar-Urgas.
Queen Silar sat at her loom in the great hall of the Algar stronghold, humming softly to herself as her fingers passed the shuttle back and forth with a drowsy, clicking sound. Sunlight streamed down from the narrow windows set high up in the wall, filling the huge, narrow room with a diffused golden light. King Kohag and Hetar were away from the stronghold, preparing a huge encampment some few leagues out from the base of the eastern escarpment for the army of the Alorns, Erens, Sindars, and Tonedrans, approaching from the west. Although he was still within the borders of the kingdom, Kohag had formally transferred authority to his wife, extracting a pledge of support from all of the assembled clan chiefs. The Queen of Algaria was a silent woman, and her calm face seldom betrayed her emotions. She had spent her entire life in the background, often so unobtrusively that people did not even realize that she was present. She had, however, kept her eyes and ears open. Her crippled husband, moreover, had confided in her. His quiet, dark-haired queen knew exactly what was going on. Elvar, archpriest of Algaria, stood white-robed and much puffed up with his own importance, reading to her the set of carefully prepared proclamations that would effectively transfer all power to him. His tone was condescending as he explained them to her.
"Is that all?"
she asked when he had finished.
"It is really for the best, Your Highness," he told her loftily. "All the world knows that women are unsuited to rule. Shall I send for pen and ink?"
"Not just yet, Elvar,"
she replied calmly, her hands busy at her loom.
"But
you know, I just had the oddest thought," she said, looking directly at him. "You are the archpriest of Bela here in Algaria, but you never go out of the stronghold. Is that not quite peculiar?"
"My duties, Your Highness, compel me."
"Isn't your first duty to the people, and to the children of Belar? We have been terribly selfish keeping you here, when your heart must be yearning to be out among the clans, overseeing the religious instruction of the children."
He stared at her, his mouth suddenly agape.
"And all of the other priests as well," she continued. "They all seem to be concentrated here at the stronghold, pressed into administrative duties. A priest is too valuable a man for such tasks. This situation must be corrected immediately."
"But
no, Elvar. My duty as queen is absolutely clear. The children of Algaria must come first. I release you from all of your duties here at the stronghold so that you may return to your chosen vocation."
She smiled suddenly.
"I'll even draw up the itinerary for you myself."
She thought a moment.
"The times are troubled, so perhaps I'd better provide you with an escort, several trustworthy men from my own clan who can be depended upon to make sure that you are not interrupted in your travels or distracted from your preaching by any disturbing messages from abroad."
She looked at him again.
"That will be all, Elvar? You had probably better go pack. It will be a number of seasons before you return, I imagine."
The archpriest of Belar was making strangled noises.
"Oh, and one other thing."
The queen carefully chose another skein of yarn and held it up to the sunlight.
"It has been years since anyone made a survey of the herds. As long as you're going to be out there anyway, I think I'd like an accurate count of all of the calves and colts in Algaria. It will give you something to occupy your mind. Send me a report from time to time, won't you?"
She returned to her weaving.
"You are dismissed, Elvar."
she said placidly, not even bothering to look up as the priest, shaking with rage, tottered away to make preparations for his roving imprisonment. Lord Morin, High Chamberlain to His Imperial Majesty Ranborun the 23rd, sighed as he entered the Emperor's private garden. Another tirade was undoubtedly in the offing, and Morin had already heard it all a dozen times at least. The Emperor had an extraordinary capacity for repeating himself sometimes. Ranborun, however, was in an odd mood. The bald, beak-nosed little Emperor sat pensively in his chair beneath a shady arbor, listening to the trilling of his canary.
"He's never spoken again.
Did you know that, Morin?" the Emperor said as his chamberlain approached across the close-clipped grass.
"Just that one time, when Bulgara was here."
He looked at the little bird again, his eyes sad, then sighed.
"I think I came out second best in that bargain. Bulgara gave me a canary and took Tenedra in exchange."
He looked around at his sun-drenched garden and the cool marble walls surrounding it.
"Is it just my imagination, Morin? Or does the palace seem sort of cold and empty now?"
He lapsed once more into moody silence, staring with unseeing eyes at a bed of crimson roses. Then there was an odd sound, and Lord Morin looked sharply at the Emperor, half afraid that his ruler was about to go into another seizure. But there was no evidence of that. Instead, Morin perceived that Ranborun was chuckling.
"Didn't you see how she tricked me, Morin?" the Emperor laughed. "She deliberately goaded me into that fit. What a son she would have made! She could have been the greatest emperor in Tolnedra's history."
Ranborun was laughing openly now, his secret delight at Tenedra's cleverness suddenly emerging.
"She is your daughter, after all, Your Majesty,"
Lord Morin observed.
"To think that she could raise an army of that size when she is barely 16,
the Emperor marveled.
"What a splendid child."
He seemed quite suddenly to have recovered from the gloomy peevishness that had dogged him since his return to Tol Hanath. His laughter trailed away after several moments, and his bright little eyes narrowed shrewdly.
"Those legions she stole from me are likely to become fractious without professional leadership. I'd say that is Tenedra's problem, Your Majesty,"
Morin replied.
"Or Bulgara's?"
"Well," the Emperor scratched one ear, "I don't know, Morin. The situation out there is not too clear."
He looked at his chamberlain.
"Are you acquainted with General Varana?"
"The Duke of Anadir?"
"Of course, Your Majesty. A thoroughly professional sort of fellow. Solid, unassuming, extremely intelligent."
"He is an old friend of the family,"
Ranborun confided.
"Tenedra knows him, and she will listen to his advice. Why don't you go to him, Morin, and suggest that he might want to take a leave of absence, perhaps go to Algarian and have a look at things?"
"I'm certain that he would be overjoyed at the idea of a vacation,"
Lord Morin agreed.
"Garrison life in the summertime can be a very tedious..."
"It is just a suggestion,"
the Emperor stressed.
"His presence in the war zone would have to be strictly unofficial."
"Naturally, Your Majesty."
"And if he just happened to make a few suggestions, or even provide a bit of leadership, we certainly would not have any knowledge of it, would we? After all, what a private citizen does with his own time is his business, right?"
"Absolutely, Your Majesty."
The Emperor grinned broadly.
"And we will all stick to that story, won't we, Morin?"
"Like glue, Your Majesty,"
Morin replied gravely. The Crown Prince of Drasnia burped noisily in his mother's ear, sighing and promptly falling asleep on her shoulder. Queen Porin smiled at him, tucked him back in his cradle, and turned again to the stringy-appearing man in nondescript clothing who sprawled in a nearby chair. The emaciated man was known only by the peculiar name Javelin. Javelin was the chief of the Drasnian Intelligence Service and one of Porin's closest advisers.
"Anyway," he continued his report, "the Tonedren girls' army is about 2 days' march from the stronghold. The engineers are moving along ahead of schedule with the hoists on top of the escarpment, and the Tareks are preparing to begin the portage from the east bank of the Aldur."
"Everything seems to be going according to plan, then," the queen said, resuming her seat at the polished table near the window.
"There's a bit of trouble in Arendia," Javelin noted. "The usual ambushes and bickerings. Nothing really serious. Queen Layla's got the Tonedren, Brevor, so completely off balance that he might as well not even be in Sindaria."
He scratched at his long, pointed jaw.
"There is peculiar information coming out of Stisith's store. The Morgos are trying to negotiate something, but their emissaries keep dying. We'll try to get somebody closer to Tardy to find out exactly what is going on. Let's see. What else? Oh, the Harniths have finally united behind one candidate, a pompous Aragorn jackass who has offended just about everybody in Tor-Annath. They'll try to buy the crown for him, but he would be hopelessly incompetent as emperor. Even with all of their money, it's going to be difficult for them to put him on the throne. I guess that's about all, Your Highness."
"I have had a letter from Aelina and Val Alorn,"
Queen Porin told him.
"Yes, Your Highness," Javelin replied urbanely. "I know."
"Javelin, have you been reading my mail again?"
she demanded, with a sudden flash of irritation.
"I am just trying to stay current with what's going on in the world, Porin."
"I have told you to stop that."
"You didn't really expect me to do it, did you?"
He seemed actually surprised. She laughed.
"You are impossible."
"But of course I am. I am supposed to be."
"Can we get any help to Aelina?"
"I'll put some people on it. We can probably work through Meryl, the wife of the Earl of Trelheim. She is starting to show some signs of maturity, and she is close to Aelina."
"I think we had better have a close look at our own intelligence service, too,"
Porin suggested.
"Let's pin down everyone who might have any connections with the Bear Cult. The time might come when we will have to take steps."
Javelin nodded his agreement. There was a light tapping at the door.
"Yes,"
Porin answered. The door opened, and a servant thrust his head into the room.
"Excuse me, Your Highness, but there's a Nadrak merchant here, a man named Jarblek. He says he wants to discuss the salmon run."
The servant looked perplexed. Queen Porin straightened in her chair.
"Send him in,"
she ordered.
"At once."
Chapter 9. The speeches were over. The orations that had caused Princess Tenedra such agony had done their work, and she found herself less and less in the center of things. At first, the days opened before her full of glorious freedom. The dreadful anxiety that had filled her at the prospect of addressing vast crowds of men 2 or 3 times a day was gone now. Her nervous exhaustion disappeared, and she no longer awoke in the middle of the night trembling and terrified. For almost an entire week, she reveled in it, luxuriated in it. Then, of course, she became dreadfully bored. The army she had gathered in Arendia and northern Tolnedra moved like a great sea in the foothills of Ogoland. The Mimbrate knights, their armor glittering in the bright sunlight and their long, streaming, many-colored pennons snapping in the breeze, moved at the forefront of the host. And behind them, spreading out across the rolling green hills, marched the solid mass of Tenedra's infantry— Sendars, Asturians, Rivens, and a few Kereks. And there, solidly in the center, forming the very core, marched the gleaming ranks of the legions of Imperial Tonedra, their crimson standards aloft and the white plumes on their helmets waving in time to their measured steps. It was very stirring for the first few days to ride at the head of the enormous force, moving at her command toward the east. But the novelty of it all soon wore thin. Princess Tenedra's gradual drift away from the center of the command was largely her own fault. The decisions now had to do more often than not with logistics. Tedious little details concerning bivouac areas and field kitchens. And Tenedra found discussions of such matters tiresome. Those details, however, dictated the snail's pace of her army. Quite suddenly, to everyone's astonishment, King Folrak of Sindaria became the absolute commander of the host. It was he who decided how far they would march each day, when they would rest, and where they would set up each night's encampment. His authority derived directly from the fact that the supply wagons were his. Quite early during the march down through northern Arendia, the dumpy-looking Sindarian monarch had taken one look at the rather sketchy plans the Alorn kings had drawn up for feeding the troops, had shaken his head in disapproval, and that had taken charge of that aspect of the campaign himself. Sindaria was a land of farms, and her storehouses bulged. Moreover, at certain seasons, every road and lane in Sindaria crawled with wagons. With an almost casual efficiency, King Folrak issued a few orders, and soon whole caravans of heavily laden wagons moved down through Arendia to Tolnedra, and then turned eastward to follow the army. The pace of the army was dictated by those creaking supply wagons. They were only a few days into the Ulgo foothills when the full weight of King Folrak's authority became clear.
"Folrak," King Rodar of Drasnia objected when the King of the Sundars called a halt for yet another rest period. "If we don't move any faster than this, it will take us all summer to get to the eastern escarpment."
"You're exaggerating, Rodar," King Folrak replied mildly. "We're making pretty good time.
The supply wagons are heavy, and the wagon horses have to be rested every hour."
"Oh, this is impossible. I'm going to pick up the pace."
"Well, that's up to you, of course." The brown-bearded Sindar shrugged, coolly eyeing Rodar's vast paunch. "But if you exhaust my wagon horses today, you won't eat tomorrow."
And that ended that. The going in the steep passes of Ogoland was even slower. Tenedra entered that land of thick forests and rocky crags with apprehension. She vividly remembered the flight with Grol the Eldrak and the attacks of the Algroths and the Hrogan that had so terrified her that previous winter. There were few meetings with the monsters that lurked in the Ulgo Mountains, however. The army was so large that even the fiercest creatures avoided it. Mondoralan, the Baron of Vomandor, rather regretfully reported only brief sightings.
"Mayhap, if I were to ride a day's march in advance of our main force, I might find opportunity to engage some of the more, frolicsome beasts," he mused aloud one evening, staring thoughtfully into the fire.
"You never get enough, do you?"
Barak asked him pointedly.
"Never mind, Mandoralan," Polra told the great knight. "The creatures are not hurting us, and the Gorum of Ulgo would be happier if we did not bother them."
Mandoralan sighed.
"Easy. Who is like that?"
King Unheg asked Barak curiously.
"You have absolutely no idea,"
Barak replied. The slow march through Ogoland, regardless of how much it chafed Rodar, Brand, and Unheg, did, however, conserve the strength of the army, and they came down onto the plains of Algaria in surprisingly good shape.